Okay, so we have a good half hour for discussion, and we're going to open it up to everybody in the room and everybody who's participated so far today. That was an extraordinary performance. Thank you. And I think, you know, it's framed and performed in interesting ways, those in-between spaces that Jim concluded on. How do you respect that kind of knowledge that gets produced in these hard to define and categorize in-between spaces? But let's open it up for conversation first, and we'll weave our way through and try to capture some of the learning today. So let's open it up.
Can I say something? Absolutely. I'm kind of interested, just picking up on Des's presentation, in that tension between, Des said something about, as an artist going into a place, we're interested in other people's stories and the tension of ethnography. And that I suppose, and I'm interested in what happens to us as practitioners when we go into those spaces and how we attend to that. And that's why I suppose we chose a particular content today. We decided not quite so much to talk about the work, the like what has happened and the things we've done, but more our own experiences as part of that and our collaborators. But I'm interested in that tension about how we talk about the work and don't get too lost in our own indulgence around our own experiences of it, and yet recognise what happens, what kind of learning is to be found when we do look into ourselves and what's going on for us as practitioners. And like Dylan Tighe's quote, when you look at yourself and your own class and you find what happens when you relate that to where you are, something new happens. So I just, something about that for me, it's that tension between talking about the practice and the issues. I suppose the first part of the day was looking at class and inequality. So
yeah, I mean, I think maybe you want to kind of elaborate on what I perceive to be a critique, Des, of the use of ethnography or autobiography or autoethnography, whatever you want to call it, in sort of artists engaging with the kind of motive of reflection. And do you want to kind of elaborate that? Because I don't think you were quite critiquing it per se, were you?
I'm just suggesting a certain self-indulgence could creep in, you know. Journalists, I think documentary filmmakers, well, pride themselves in that they're not the story. The story is out there and they're trying to sort of capture. Now, that can be disingenuous as well, because clearly they bring their own sensibilities and subjectivity and will shape the way they tell the story, particularly journalists who work within very distinct professional codes, as do documentary filmmakers as well. But I think there's a sense, and it's been reported particularly in terms of tradition, say, of photography within the art school, that this preoccupation with self rather than, you know, the engagement with the world, and that can lead then to the disappearance of, you know, the human figure completely from the image, and the very refusal to engage with, you know, social relations and historical determinations one form or another. And it's that sense that I think I'm not using youth workers at all, or those who work in community socially engaged art, quite the reverse. I think they're fairly alert to those cultural differences that arise when they enter into, you know, working class community. But there certainly are traditions within the art school which have now embraced what appears to be the intellectual rigor of the notion of autoethnography, which are narcissistic, you know, not to be admitted.
Yeah. Yeah, that's your opinion. We might debate that.
Yeah. I mean, Des, I understand what you're saying, but I think it very much depends on the specificities of the particularities of a given creative project, in a way. And the autoethnographic kind of impulse, if you like, is you know, can be configured in so many different ways. And there are versions, which I think is what you're saying. There are particular versions, whether it's a documentary film or it's a piece of writing, that do, you know, that can be construed as being very kind of extreme or narcissistic, okay, as you say. But I think that when it's done well, okay, and when the individual subject, okay, doesn't see him or herself as a central character, okay, in the story, it is a vehicle of sorts for a wider kind of, a wider narrative about other people who find themselves in similar circumstances. It does and can become a very kind of compelling modality of representation in a way. So I think, you know, this is not an either or. I think there are many, many examples where it's done very well, where the kind of socio-political reach of the project is there, and it's not about the individual subject. And of course, there are examples where it's quite the opposite. So I mean, that's what I was saying.
Can I ask the four performers at the end, why did you choose, and obviously you've done a version of this before in a different context, why do you choose to exchange your stories and perform the voices in the way that you did?
I mean, I think it's right. The What's the Story project, as the quote from Catherine earlier, was we found this form by accident when we realised that we had gathered stories along the way in the project, and we couldn't find a way of sharing those stories. One of the things that we realised was that, I suppose, the respect issue around people said things casually that they maybe didn't, that they didn't value, but when someone else emphasised it and said it, it gave it a new kind of a new value. But also hearing another person say in the rehearsal of this, every time I heard Nicola speak, I'd kind of die inside a little bit, because when you hear what you've said back to you, it does something back on the what you said as well. So there's that tension, because there's new learning in hearing someone else say it. I mean, so that's where it came from. It seems that really, are we going to stand up in 10 minutes and talk about the practice? You know, I suppose we couldn't quite figure out what we'd even say, so then we thought, well, let's just give people insight into the practice, but rather than even just read, say our own bits, would be excruciating, that we'd have to try to take on the other's role and just see what that felt like. So,
For me, I'm a real, for me, around this collaboration thing, I just think it's so difficult to do, right? And I think we give a lot of lip service to what collaboration is, right? I remember sitting on partnership boards and local drugs task forces, right, where the state and the community were supposed to be coming together, right, supposed to be coming together to deal with the exclusion of marginalised people. That's what that was its main function, right? And yet, right, nobody could talk openly and honestly about what they were doing there. You had all the state departments, all of the departments, social protection, department of health, all of them sitting in the room, right? And you raise a single question about some exclusion or other, right? And the silence that descended. I mean, I learned something about bureaucracy in those settings where the silence that descended on the room, right, was just, I mean, it was screaming at me. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't. So for me, can someone turn that? For me, the whole idea of collaboration is so difficult because it demands that you must put yourself into it, right?
Yeah.
It cannot be a known person. You have to be who you are, in my belief, right? If you're going to really collaborate, you have to put yourself in there. You have to put your values in there. You have to put your beliefs in there, your principles in there. You have to put it in there. And if you're not prepared to do that, well, then I don't believe you're collaborating, because it is that debate, it is that difficulty of that debate and that difference that you have to overcome. And it's full of it. I mean, it's full of it. John and myself are always sort of teasing out the subtleties of that, because we would be very similar in how we think about the work, but John has a very particular view, and I probably have a nuanced view of that. And we would spend a lot of time jostling around that. I mean, Fiona and myself did that for 10 years in relation to most of this work. That's what we did. We sat and we had to put ourselves into the room. Now, I don't believe people are prepared to do that. I am a real skeptic. I'm a real negative person because I don't believe people are prepared to do that. I think it's so difficult to put yourself into the room. I watch the youth workers and I watch them really putting themselves into that space and really making an effort. And so the work that we do, and that I watch youth workers do with artists, right, is incredible.
And I think what it raises, just to kind of keep moving and then we'll go back out again, is that notion of unsettling authority as well, you know, in terms of that method that you've just described. And I'm wondering, and this goes back to your analysis, Des, of the kind of so-called self-indulgence, and it can be the case, but I think in this instance, you know, and I'm thinking what Lars was talking about, policy, I mean, can you imagine a performance like this happening in an academic institution where the people who claim to have authority over the discourse would step into that space that Jim described and unloosen and unshackle, if you like, their kind of sense of privilege and also their sense of ego and begin to see the landscape, the policies, the issues and the questions from a completely other perspective? This question.
Can I imagine it?
No.
Just as I can't imagine a scenario where in a partnership involving different organisations and institutions coming together, such as Jim referred to there, I can't imagine it happening there unless something extraordinary happened and people had an awful lot of time and had some way of freeing themselves, even temporarily or even pretending to free themselves of their from their institutional links, because the kind of experience that we had here, the enactment that you all engaged in, it was an account of a type of exchange. Even though you were taking other people's roles, the kinds of communication you had and the context was one in which you weren't fundamentally putting yourselves in a position of danger, I think. At least you weren't representing an institution or an organization. Isn't that true?
Yep.
Whereas if somebody's in a position exchanging with others and they are there as a representative of an organization or an institution, the implications are much greater. Mm-hmm. There's an awful lot more at stake and you've more to lose. And so I can't imagine what you've suggested there happening on Brianna. But I think what you have done, and you've given a great example of it, is hugely worthwhile for those who do get to participate in.
I think, I mean, it relates to me with the Gardaí. Obviously, it's a different type of institution. But when we engaged the Gardaí directly in this type of a reading and reenactment and invited the Gardaí, 26 Gardaí, to be part of an event where they would read aloud the stories of young people's experiences of the Gardaí, one of the big issues that emerged was whether we were dealing with them as individuals or as representatives of their organisation. A little bit like that, in the sense that could you actually affect change by willing someone to hear another's experience and maybe have some kind of a shift in their head, or how do you begin to affect the institution that they were part of? And that tension between the individual and the organisation became really huge for us then, you know, in terms of, like, so I think we tried it on two levels, in terms of giving those 26 some kind of personal experience in a new way of reenacting young people, in the presence of some of those young people and their collective, but also working on developing training out of that and trying to affect the institution. But it becomes a real tension when someone is attached to an organisation. They're not free to change their mind.
Yeah.
But then, why engage in the practice in the first place?
Oh, that old gem.
By engaging which job?
No, I think the police and dialogues raised all sorts of questions in terms of power, you know, like one of the points made earlier, I think, by Kathleen, was like locally, the experience in the stories is locally. They come into the house, they wreck your gaff because they're looking for something that they think is hidden there. And that's that kind of very subjective, grounded experience that filtered into, that was in all of a lot of the stories. And like, at some level, we think we can make a dent in that, right? And maybe the question I'm posing is about how big we make the frame, right? So when you get them to sit down and you discover that the institution doesn't shift from that space, and you find, like, the question is, what does the institution actually do, right? So the point that was made earlier about youth projects are set up in working class communities, right? So we can say they do that because it's a right? It's either a SOP or it's a something to a form of control, actually, right? If we're self-critical, right? And I think we need to be kind of critical of ourselves in the sense of understanding that bit, right? Because one of the big questions we have at the moment is, it doesn't matter what youth projects do, actually, right? Because all the policies the state has driven have destroyed everything, right? At a grassroots level, just about in the past 6 years, right? So we need to understand that piece, right? But yeah, we need to go on and we need to continue, right? It's the old Beckett stuff, right? In the sense of how do we deal with that? That we continue to work, right? But there is a real tension between the bigger stuff that's been pushing down on people, right? And the increases in violence and the increase in drug use, right? They're not separate at that level. So I think that's a, you know what I mean? Like there are different things going on at the moment. Like the last few weeks have been swinging things back in the opposite direction, right? So on Saturday, the most people have ever demonstrated in this country. So I think that's really hopeful, right? And we marched from Rialto, for instance, where we started with 60 and we had about 1,200 by the time we got to Meat Street. So there's something changing, like in terms of people actually beginning to say back to the state, fuck off, we've had enough of you. Go and fuck yourself, right? And they need to say it much more to them in the sense of the sheer arrogance, the imposition of austerity on people, the belief that, you know, and then the reactions we've seen since, right? And John, whatever his name is, calling us customers again on the 6 o'clock news yesterday, right? So I think that the place we find ourselves in, we need to kind of spend time trying to understand it. So are our police force effectively working to keep capitalism working away, right? That's what, do you know what I mean? So it's not just about subjective stories from Rialto, right? Which are really painful and all that. We need to see it in a bit. And that sort of analysis is, you don't even get to talk to them, I think, if you begin to put that stuff in. That it's ultimately, like, I think we do need to ask questions about class, right? What does class mean in the country now? How does it cross over with gender, for instance, with young men and young women, right? Because it's at the core of the stuff that we're talking about today in terms of the project. And like one of the things that worries me is in relation to the youth project is the limitations of projects to be dissenting, right? And what's going to happen when we really dissent? So we have big panels in Rialto which have all of the politicians on them, and they have a big strip banner across them that says austerity kills, right? Now I think if we put that out as a public advertisement across the project, we might have funding problems afterwards, right? There is a tension within the project locally about how much we can dissent, right? I mean, more than just that, we've got to ask the questions, but we've got to critically dissent, right, and say no, actually. But that, I think that means we may well have to pay a price for that, because we know from the past few years about what the suppression of dissent means, when Brian Harvey's written about it and other people as well. So maybe that's one of them. I don't know what you think about that, Morris, in terms of the limitations of projects. When you get to that space, right, when you really begin to dissent, what, you know, anyway.
Well, there's no question about what happened, really, because what you've just described it, there's a fair Kathleen Lynch referred to it earlier as well, that when there was significant dissent, community projects and youth projects paid the price already. So it's already clear, and those, the very people who were prepared to express dissent and pay the price are in a weaker position now than they ever were. So things aren't going to change in that regard, I think. In a certain sense, what needs to happen is that the community and youth work project need to be given a more secure space in society. In a certain sense, it's what an old British textbook called being in and against the state, that the state has to acknowledge that a certain level of dissent is acceptable. Even radical dissent is acceptable. Mm-hmm. And the practitioners have to acknowledge that a certain level of accommodation to the state also has to be accepted. The only alternative is revolution. So that it is actually about compromise. Doesn't, I don't know if that answers your question, but I can't, there isn't a simple answer to the question.
Just a real honour to see you all up there doing the piece again and in a different form. I've been witnessing Fiona and the Youth Project working together for those 10 years on the sidelines, and it's been really interesting and a privilege. I suppose when I'm hearing John speak and I hear Fiona speak and Jim and Nicola and Maurice and Mika, I'm thinking of what Kathleen said earlier, which is that piece, which is about the mind being the site of political struggle and how you open up spaces for that, that might have to come outside of the institution, that might have to just be formed by ourselves. And John has been involved in that in the spectacle. But I think those are the spaces that are where we can dissent freely and where we can think freely, where we can discuss and critique freely and form other ways of thinking. And I think it's just that other part which you talked about, Anya, which was that whole idea of being the public learning in the local place. So it's about that transferring from the local to the national, if you like. And I just feel that the hybrid practice that you describe has a huge potential for young people that you work with, for youth workers that you work with, for artists that are here. It's got a huge potential, and I think there's an opportunity. And I think people like Anya and Kathleen and Maurice and other institutions are open to having that interdisciplinary dialogue. And I think this is maybe the rupture or the gap where we go into another space and take another opportunity together in a different collective, in a collective that's probably more honest than some of the ones we've been involved in. But, so I see this as a really interesting opportunity to dissent in a different way and to have that dialogue in a different way. And I just want to say thank you.